Hi, I'm Jerry Varmash, and this is Here Now the News. Today, an endearing TV host is my guest, Bob Eubanks. This is Bob's second appearance on the podcast. He previously joined me last year to reflect on the life of Alex Trebek, so we'll revisit Jeopardy since our last conversation. But of course, we'll also chat about what he's most remembered for, the Newlywed Game. Plus his long connection to the music industry, Bob has plenty of stories to tell. And he reminisces about his start in broadcasting more than 60 years ago.
When I got out of high school, I went to a radio school in Hollywood called the Don Martin School of Radio and Television. And from there, I got my first radio job. This is 1958, at a 250-watt radio station in Oxnard, California. 200 watts went into the ocean, 50 watts went to the cemetery next door. And I literally... You know, I even had a rock and roll album giveaway contest, and I said, I'll give them the first person that calls, and nobody called. So one morning I got off the air and I drove to the hot new station in LA, KRLA, and I wanted to see what the big guys look like. So I'm sitting in the lobby and there's a disc jockey meeting going on, and I realized that the all-night man had a sore back and nobody wanted to sit in for him. So I walk up to the program director and I said, well, hi there, I'm a disc jockey. And he said, do you belong to the union? I said, no. I said, but I can. So anyway, borrowed $360, joined the union, went on the air that night. And I was there 7 years to the day.
Wow. And that was it was a big lineup, right?
It was a big lineup. You know, Casey Kasem and Wink Martindale and Dave Hull, the Hullabaloo, and Reb Foster. There was a big lineup. Dick Biondi out of Chicago. It was a big lineup at the time. Yeah.
And what shift did you have primarily?
I worked midnight to 6 a.m. Sometimes a little longer because Wink Martindale would sleep in. He did the morning show. So that was the beginning of, that was the groundwork of what I eventually accomplished.
So you had the bug early, and you knew that was your
I knew that's destiny. What I wanted to do.
Yeah,
I knew also I was with some big guys, and you know you have to make yourself important if you're there with the big guys. So there was a nightclub in New York called the Peppermint Lounge, and they had a hit record. Joey D and the Starlighters had a hit record called the Peppermint Twist, which by the way, Joe Pesci played guitar in that band, and. Anyway, so I realized that there was a need for live music without booze in Southern California. So we opened three nightclubs, Cinnamon Cinders. And we had a hit record, CC Cinnamon Cinder. But it was because I was buying talent then. Every Wednesday night, I would buy talent, the Stevie Wonders and the Ike and Tina Turners and the Beach Boys and people like that. So when the Beatle thing came along, because I was a disc jockey and because I was buying talent, I had a leg up on the Beatle thing.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, I'm sure there are people who still don't know every aspect of your career and only know you for one thing, which we'll talk about certainly in a moment. They don't know that you helped bring the Beatles to LA, I guess, at least, right? Twice?
Yeah. What happened was the Beatles on February the 9th, 1964, did the Ed Sullivan Show. And I guess it was 70 million people watched that night. Hmm. I got some great stories about that, by the way.
Oh,
and,
okay.
So then they decide they're going to tour America. And they signed with an agency called GAC. GAC went to their regular promoters, a guy here in town, Lou Robin, and he'd never heard of them and thought they were just another boy band. So he turned them down because they wanted $25,000 for the Hollywood Bowl. So, you know, I didn't have $25,000. I was making $12,500 a year at the radio station. But I borrowed it on my house. And was able to present the Beatles at the Hollywood Bowl in 64 and 65. Then we did Dodger Stadium 66.
Wow. And so you and all of the DJs were there?
Oh, yeah. All the disc jockeys were there. And here again, you got to make yourself important. I was making $12.5 a year. And the first Beatle concert, I didn't save enough tickets for the press. And it was my first time ever producing a concert. And I remember in the afternoon, a busload of marshals came up the driveway. I said, what are you guys doing here? He said, well, we're here to protect the hills. I said, great. Who's paying for you? He says, you are. So the first year I made $4,000 and I had a partner. But I got real smart the second year because the Beatles 64 made KRLA number one. So I went to them and I said, okay, let's make it KRLA and Bob Eubanks Presents. And they said, okay. I said, it'll cost you $100,000. So I made more money in the Beatles at the second, third year.
Wow. Very savvy of you. Do we hear you? My friend, who you actually, he interviewed you for a Beatles show, I guess 5 or 6 years ago, he's been doing for 20 plus years. And so he's the Beatle, you know, he knows all the stuff about the Beatles, but he told me there's a song where you can hear your introduction to the Beatles. You know about that?
They are I don't know if there's a song, but there's a DVD.
Oh, maybe it's that.
Yeah. That came out called, that you can hear me introduce them.
That's it.
Here they are, the Beatles.
Right, right. That's very cool. Yeah. So that's part of pop culture. Do you have any memories with the Beatles? Did you get to interact with in your life?
First of all, Jerry, I'm writing a book right now called Short Stories About Big People. And boy, do I have Beatles stories. OMG. I got a lot of them. Just as a quick rundown, Paul was very easy to get along with. Ringo just kind of looked at you. But John and I had difficulties. I remember the first year I said, John, do me a favor. And by the way, the Beatles would only sing a half hour. And that was and they always ended with Long Tall Sally, the Little Richard song. Hmm. And I said to John, John, do me a favor. Don't say this is our last number. He said, oh, no, I can't do that. I got to say that. So that made it very difficult to get them out of the Hollywood Bowl or Dodger Stadium or anything. But we did. And we had two very successful concerts. And Dodger Stadium was successful. But in 1966, it was a band that no longer wanted to be together. And they went from Dodger Stadium to San Francisco, Candlestick Park, and that was the last time that they ever appeared for money. We couldn't sell the center field bleachers, so we put speakers out there and gave the seats to the blind children. It was time. It was time. And they knew it also.
What, did you know that going in, that it was hard to get them to perform live? Because that was always like... it was such a special treat because it seemed that they, as you even said, doing 30 minutes, that they didn't like to perform live.
Well, all they heard was screaming, and they felt they lost their musical ability because they couldn't hear themselves sing. I'll tell you a fun story. When they did the Ed Sullivan show, Sullivan happened to be at Heathrow Airport over in England, and there was a bunch of girls screaming and yelling, and he thought it was part of the family, the Queen and such. And somebody said, well, no, those are the Beatles. And he said, who in the hell are the Beatles? So anyway, he found out. So he booked them, and they had a sound check in the afternoon, and they got it all straightened out. They got all the numbers right and everything, all the dials set perfectly. And they went to dinner. Well, here comes the cleaning crew. The cleaning crew comes in and cleans the studio, including all of the knobs that had been set, the sound that had been set. And so when they went on, they sounded like hell. But no one could hear them anyway. They were, with the screams and all of that. But anyway, it was, that's why they sounded not so good the first time on the Sullivan show.
Wow. And they were performing, right? They weren't lip syncing?
No, they were performing. Yeah, they didn't lip sync.
Wow, amazing stuff. Yeah, I mean, just the little tidbits or something. I'm looking forward to the book. That'll be fun. Well, how long, when do you think you'll have that ready?
Gosh, I don't know, Jerry. You know, I'm working on it daily, but, you know, I keep changing it and everything. But I got a lot of stories, like a lot of fun stories. And I don't mean to hurt anybody's feelings, but everything I say is the truth. You know, I only had trouble with two acts in my years of working in the rock and roll business. Elton John, Barry Manilow. Very, very difficult to deal with. And I remember I had 8,000 kids in Las Vegas. And this guy comes floating up to me and he says, "We have a problem." I said, "What's your problem, man?" He says, "Elton hates cops. And he won't go on stage if he can see one in a uniform." Okay, so I go to the Las Vegas Police Department. And I said, "Guys, disappear until I get this guy on stage." And they did. But when he came off stage, I had seven of them waiting at the bottom of the steps for him. You know. But, you know, it's just stupid things like that. I had about 8,000 kids at Anaheim Convention Center. And Barry Manilow made me remove 214 kids behind the stage while he made a 10-second walk. But honestly, the rest of the world that I dealt with, I mean, Mick Jagger and I, we had a few problems because he just, he wouldn't get off stage. And the biggest problem back in those days was getting him out of there. And I remember I said, "Mick, do me a favor." I said, "There, you know, when you're done, don't do any encores or anything. Like, just put it down and get out of there and I'll get you out of here." Well, he lollygagged on stage, and by the time he got to the car, it was a stack of girls. And so that was always the biggest problem, getting them out. But most of the acts were just wonderful.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring up, you were doing the producing for the Beatles, and then you had several years. I wasn't as familiar with the pop. I knew you, certainly, country music, you had several years with success. But I wanted to first ask, since you've had so many layers of producing different genres over the years, did you ever want to just do that full time? Many people would.
No, not really. I got tired of rock and roll and it was just too tough. I'll tell you a funny story. Dave Clark Five, and they were on stage and I told them, I said, "Guys, do me a favor. When you're done, put your instruments down. I've got a limo right out that door, and there's a police officer on a motorcycle who's going to escort you out of here." And so they did that. They put their instruments down. They ran out. They got in the car, and the police officer goes, "Run-cha-cha-cha-cha," and it wouldn't start. Well, by this time, there's girls all over the car. So we finally peel most of the girls off, and I told the limo driver, I said, "Take off." So he went up into a neighborhood, and there's a girl on top of the car. And she's screaming and yelling. So he stops and gets out. And there's a man walking down the street, walking his dog. And he sees the limo driver pulling this girl off the car. And he thinks that he's molesting her. So he walks up to the limo driver and cold cocks him, bam, right there. By this time, the cop shows up. He said, "No, no, no." And it was just crazy time.
Oh, wow. So you must have seen it all, like with, as they say, sex, drugs and rock and roll, literally.
Well, my success with the Beatles opened the door for, you know, Herman and the Hermits, Cream, all of those. And but when the whole San Francisco drug culture music came along, the Janis Joplins and all of that, I decided I didn't want to deal with that. So I sold the company I had to Filmways. And I stayed out of the concert business for a couple of years. And then, because I was raised with country music, I went to a friend of mine at Capitol Records. I said, "Who's your hot act?" And he said, "Merle Haggard." I said, "Okay." So anyway, long story short, I signed Merle to an exclusive deal. And we were together 10 years. And we never had a crossword. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Wow. Did you work with other country artists or just?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did? Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Dolly Parton.
Dolly Parton. I produced George Jones and Tammy Wynette, Marty Robbins, managed Marty Robbins for a while, wow. and one Everly brother.
But, they should have had you in the Ken Burns. Did you watch the Ken Burns documentary?
No, I did not.
Oh, it's terrific. I mean, all his stuff is great.
That's the one with the history of country music?
Yeah, it was, an 8-part series. It's great. I mean, I know friends who aren't into country music, but they love it because the way he does things, you know, he links with pieces of Americana, you know, in time, the timeline. It's really good.
Well, Haggard and I, we had a wonderful relationship, but his wife at the time was jealous of our relationship, I think. And I wasn't even invited to his funeral.
Oh.
But he and I, we had an agreement. We could tell each other anything and it would never go anywhere. And we did.
Wow. You're going to write about him in the book as well? Now that
oh,
he's
yeah.
Not, yeah.
Sure.
That's great. Yeah, they had interviewed him because he didn't die that long ago. And I guess he died recently in the last couple of years.
It was 2017.
Yeah. Okay. 4 years. Yeah. And so they had done these interviews over the last few years.
I got great Merle Haggard stories though.
Oh, yeah. What? So he was a nice person, and you want to give a story? Certainly.
He was a very nice guy, and he was tough to predict sometimes, but he and I got along very well.
But not like when you say tough to predict, not like volatile.
Not like what's it?
Not volatile.
Oh, no. Right. Just, you know, you just.
And Dolly, how was Dolly? Was she everything you see on TV?
Going back to Haggard just a moment.
Sure.
His first wife's name was Leona. And he had a big tattoo put on his arm, Leona. And his fourth wife's name was Leona, by the way. So the tattoo came back. Yeah, Dolly was great to work with. What happened is I wanted Dolly Parton, and she was with Porter Wagner at the time. And so I went to Tandy Rice, Porter's agent. I said, I want some dates on Porter. He said, well, Bob, he said, Porter is very busy. He said, how many dates would you like? I said, 100. He said, we can make that happen. Yeah. So the first date out, Porter's on stage. And the only time I could talk to Porter, by the way, talk to Dolly was when Porter was on stage. And while he was on stage, she came into the dressing room. She says, I'm going to leave Porter. I want you to manage me. I thought, oh, no, I just committed for 100 dates, you know. But I got out of those dates and I managed Dolly for 2 years. And it became tough for her, though, because in Nashville, there was a lot of pressure. And having a West Coast manager put a lot of pressure on her. So, but she's wonderful.
Oh, and so you stayed in Hollywood when you were
in
the country? Yeah. So you were working for her from when she left Porter?
Yes, for 2 years.
And, which they talk about in, there's a podcast all about Dolly Parton, and they did like an 8-part series interviewing her. And then on the country music documentary, they do a whole lot about that she wrote the song, I'll Always Love You, for him, which I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was her farewell.
Yeah. But, you know, she and I, sometimes in your career, you do stupid things. And I was producing the Tony Tennille television show when 9 to 5 came out, the movie. And Jane Fonda was on the show. And I was sitting with Jane Fonda in the dressing room. And I was just complaining about the way Porter treated Dolly. And evidently, Fonda went to Dolly and told her. And that brought a problem. But she's wonderful. She's an incredible artist. And I was so thrilled when she donated $1 million there to get a vaccine going.
Oh yeah, that's great.
Just wonderful. Yeah.
That's terrific what she did with that. Yeah, and with her and Porter, even though she certainly needed to spread her wings and to be on her own instead of, as she said, be one of Porter's girls or his girl singer. It seemed right to the end that she was actually very protective of him.
Yes, she was. She was protective. And but that's her. That's her. You know, she's just, but here again, she's a delightful human being. I have nothing but good to say.
Have you stayed in touch with her?
No, I have not. I have not. You know, one of the biggest mistakes I made in my business, too, is that she came to me after 2 years of management. And she said, I can't handle the pressure anymore. So I said, I understand. Believe me, I do. And I was managing Barbara Mandrell at the time. So a year later, I get a call from Dolly. She's at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And she wanted to have a meeting. So I go down to meet with her. And she said, will you manage me again? And I said, I'll tell you tomorrow. And I was having some marital issues at home. And I went back the next day and I said, I can't do it, kid. I said, I got too many problems at home. And I said, it wouldn't be fair. So I turned it down. Dumb. Now she's worth more than Garth Brooks.
I mean, she's amazing. And she's still gone. She's still performing.
And I, you know, and the 2 years I managed her, I never met her husband. You know, but I understand they just celebrated 50 years.
So, yeah, have you stayed in touch with any of your any of the talent? I know Merle, obviously. Well, did you stay in touch with him over the years?
Merle is gone. George Jones is gone. Tammy is gone. Marty Robbins is gone. Johnny Cash is gone. I find it interesting that Jerry Lee Lewis is a big drinker and Willie Nelson's a big pot smoker. And they're both still here.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, Willie, we see. And yeah, that's right about Jerry Lee Lewis. I don't know.
Jerry was on a big date at Cobo Hall in Detroit. There was like eight acts on the date. And the person who went on last was usually considered the star. So Jerry stayed out in the car listening until all of the other acts went on. But he was drinking. So when he finally got up on the stage, he started singing and slurring his words, and the audience started to boo. So Jerry said, all right, gosh darn it. If you don't like my show, go get your money back. Well, 13,000 people got up and headed for the box office, and the poor promoter's running like hell. He didn't have to give any money back.
Were you close with, you guys were contemporaries, in TV and producing game shows? I was thinking Dick Clark. Where did you sit with him in terms of an association?
Was I close with Dick? Not necessarily, no. But Dick Clark showed the rest of us as disc jockeys that we could do more than be a disc jockey. And but I wasn't close with him, no. I went to his memorial. It was wonderful. Paul Anka was there singing Put Your Head on My Shoulder. And it was just an incredible outdoor event down at the ocean. But he showed the rest of us we could do more than be a disc jockey.
Right. And he had done not just the on-air stuff and the TV, radio, TV, obviously Bandstand, but he had his, and I think it's still on his production company, I believe, is still like the Golden Globe Awards, things like that.
Yeah, they still produce something. I forget what it is.
I think the Golden Globe Awards.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so.
I believe so. Yeah, they still have that. I think his Casey Kasem, you mentioned him earlier. You filled in for him. I know. I think I read twice you filled in on American Top 40. Is that true?
Yeah, and you know, Casey would always keep your head in
Keep your head
in the stars and keep reaching for something.
Yeah, keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the
stars. Keep your feet on the ground, keep reaching for the stars. So when I filled in for him, I said, well, keep your feet in the stars and keep reaching for the ground. And made him mad. He never invited me back.
Oh, really? Oh, because you were making fun of his signature line? Oh,
he was a very good guy and he made a lot of money. And he was very talented.
Yeah, and he did, voiceovers and like. Did you do voiceover work?
No, and if you hear my voice right now, it sounds like I have a frog in my throat. And I'm sorry about that.
No, it sounds fun.
But no, I didn't do any voiceover, no.
I was thinking of that because obviously Casey was...
Casey did a lot of
Scooby-Doo, he did, and many others. He was on Super Friends, he did Robin.
For quite a while.
He did the NBC promos for prime time. Yeah,
yes.
He did numerous things like that. So yeah, you filled in for him, I think it was in the early 80s, I think,
yeah,
81, 82, something like that. That was the height, late 70s, early 80s was the height of American Top 40. And then he did the TV half hour Top 10. Did you fill in for him on there as well? Or
no, I did not. You know, he had a difficult time with his marriage. And I believe Casey had passed away, and it was 2 years before they actually buried him because there was all kinds of legal stuff going on, I believe.
Right. I know that was that, you know, there was a lot of fodder for the tabloids and the documentaries and things.
Yeah.
And it was sad. It was a sad way that, you know, such a radio icon, a broadcasting legend. And it just it dragged through the mud where we were all taking, you know, getting to be part of this, unfortunately. And it was sad.
He was originally from Detroit. When he went to work for KRLA, he was supporting his family in Detroit. You know, he was a really good guy.
That's nice to hear. So it's nice that you get to hear that until he doesn't like if you did something, you know, but he didn't say anything, right? He just didn't bring you back when you said that at the end.
Yeah, no, he didn't. He just didn't bring me back. And then we had a morning man, Bob Hudson, who Casey was friends with. Emperor Hudson, they called him. One night he went to a Laker basketball game, a big championship game. And he came back the next morning. He said, the Lakers lost. He said, it was fixed. It was fixed. Well, they got off the air at 9 o'clock. And there were three attorneys in the lobby, one for the Lakers, one for the NBA, and one for the other basketball team. And so he had to read an apology every 15 minutes on the air for 2 weeks.
When I first wrote you about doing this interview, I was, and not that I needed to find a specific reason or an anniversary, but there it was. The Newlywed Game debuted almost, I think it was almost to the day, 55 years ago in 1966.
Yeah. From the Chuck Barris stages in Hollywood, California, here come the Newlyweds. Yes, it's the Newlywed Game.
I auditioned every disc jockey in town.
Is that right?
And I was lucky enough to win that audition. God only knows why. But they auditioned disc jockeys then, and then later on they auditioned weathermen, like Sajak and David Letterman were weathermen. And now it's actors and comedians. And
right. My
personal opinion is that actors, other than Steve Harvey, actors and comedians make lousy game show hosts because they can't stand for anybody to be funnier than they are. I produced Buddy Hackett's You Bet Your Life.
Right. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
And, we had a lady on one time that could hum and whistle the same tune at the same time. And he brought her to tears because he couldn't stand it. It's just in their body that nobody can be funnier than they are.
Right. You can't upstage the comedian.
No. And so, but I learned how to make people talk. And Chuck Barris gave me the opportunity to do that. And it took a while. He came to me after I'll tell you a story. I'm standing in the dressing room, getting ready to go out and do my first Newlywed Game. And I'm still working at KRLA. And there's a knock on the door. I open the door. And I said, hi there. Here stands two guys in suits. And I flash ABC here to say, good luck, Bob. And they said, Bob? I said, yeah. And he says, you're here by order to appear before the United States Government Anti-Payola Committee, and you damn sure better be there. I got served a felony subpoena 30 seconds before I went out to do my first Newlywed Game. So after the show, Chuck Barris came to me and he said, Bobby, we got to talk. I said, what's the matter? He said, you've just done something I've never seen anybody do before. I said, what'd I do, man? He said, you went a half hour without blinking. That's how scared I was. When Varus developed the Newlywed Game, we had to show it to the big guys in New York. So they all flew out to Hollywood, and we're in a studio there with no cameras, lights, microphones. Couple number one was an unknown comedian named Dom DeLuise and his wife, Carol. Now, this is 64, and television was pretty calm. So the big guys from New York are sitting in the front row, and I was a cute little blonde down at the end. I said, "What's your favorite nickname for your husband?" She said, "Numbnuts." And the ABC guys got up, flipped over backwards, went upstairs and bought the show without a pilot based upon that answer.
The term making whoopee, was that your line?
Here's your host, the star of the Newlywed Game, Bob Eubank. Thank you. Welcome to the Newlywed Game. It is I, the king of whoopee.
Yeah, what happens was they wanted me to say make love, and I wouldn't do it because I had young children, and I didn't think you should have to explain what make love meant until you were ready to do so. So Sinatra had a hit record called Making Whoopee. And I said, I'll go with Whoopee, but I won't say make love. And that's how it came down.
Barris, it seems like he was a character.
He was.
Yeah.
First time I walked in his office, there was a urinal on the wall. You know, he just said all kinds of crazy things. And they would have parades through the hall, the whole nine yards. But he always favored the dating game over Newlywed Game. But he only sent me two memos. And they were both very constructive criticism in the many years I did the show. And I did the show 5 decades with original programming, if you can believe that.
What did you think of the quote unquote autobiography that he did and then was made into a movie with George Clooney, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind?
Yeah.
That he's apparently
he
in
was
the CIA.
Not part of the CIA, I can tell you that.
He was not, okay.
God, no.
So that was just this, he was putting this whole bit together.
Yep. You know, and they auditioned, trying to think of Gary, what would Gary, a host by the name of Gary. Anyway, they were pitching the Gong Show at NBC. And the NBC boys said, well, who do you suggest? And they said, I forget the guy's name. Anyway, when they left, Barris looked at his friend. And he says, don't even call him. I'm going to host that show. And he did. And he did a good job with it, too.
It seems like your styles are not necessarily in sync. Did you get along with him?
Yeah, very much so. He was a real character. It was fun.
Was it a hit from the start?
Yeah, we really were. The first week we went on the air, we kicked butt, and we had a hit show. We knew it. You know, I just had to learn how to do it. They let me learn how to make people talk. What I learned is people don't want to know about you. They want you to know about them. And if I would ask a couple a question and I would get a good answer, I would look at the other three couples and I knew where I was going to get my next good answer.
Will your husband say he is basically more urban or rural, Kathy?
I don't know what they mean.
You know it. Now you married him. What do you think?
Heck, he's urban.
He's urban.
Yeah.
How long has he been that way?
About 2 months.
2 months he's been there. Do you think there's anything he can do about it?
He went to a doctor.
Oh, he did.
If I tried to put the contestant down, or, you know, what are you talking about? How can it doesn't work? You know, here again, people want you to know about them. And that's what I learned.
And this was all, obviously, you had to ad lib this other than asking the questions because this wasn't planned. You didn't know what they were going to say ahead of time, right?
See, one of the things I learned, let's say you walk into an office for a very important meeting and you've never met the gentleman before. When I walk into an office like that, I immediately look and see what kind of pictures are on his desk, what's he got on the wall. And before the meeting starts, I ask him, wow, is that your son? Does he play football? Where does he play? The moment that you ask the person you're having a meeting with about them, the meeting goes well. Works every time.
I mean, you were a master. I mean, we talked the last time about, you know, what you learned from Carson. And in some ways, you have that ability when Carson is chatting with people on the couch and you interacting with what's even harder because you're not talking to celebrities who are used to that. You're talking to, you know, average citizens. And
but I learned a lot from John.
Did you?
Yeah, learned a lot. When he was done with someone, they couldn't get any more funny answers. He'd move them right down the couch and bring somebody else on. And I met him only this way. I was doing a show at NBC and we would meet in the parking lot. Hi, Bob. Hi, John. That was it. But I learned a great deal from him, really.
You had that knack to, you know, not only to get them to speak, but to, you know, comfort them, to disarm them. And then, of course, to keep poking at them in such a lovable way.
Here again, I learned how to do it. And I think Steve Harvey is wonderful. I really do. But comedians have a real rough time. I was sitting in the dressing room at the Palladium one time with Bob Hope and Joey. What is Joey's last name?
Bishop.
Anyway, yeah, Joey Bishop. There were four very popular comedian types, and they were telling jokes. And they would go, you hear the one about the lady in Orange County? That, yeah, I've heard that. But that's the way it worked. Yeah, I've heard that. Nobody finished the joke because people couldn't stand for anybody else to be funny. It's just crazy.
And you were obviously not as a comedian. You were in a different spot. You were trying to, you know, get them to you were giving them the stage, but yet you were still at the center of it. It was remarkable the way you did that.
The audience. I wasn't the star of the show. The couples in the format were. I was just the person that ran it. So.
Well, could that show have worked with someone else?
Yeah, sure. But you know, they're going to bring it back right now. I heard they're bringing it back. I don't know who the host is. I have no idea in the world, but it would work with someone else as long as they understand the quality of the format, making the couples the stars and having fun. And with today's, they're going to say make love, of course. They're going to do all of those. But Whoopi ain't going to work. We had a lady on the show one time. I said, where's the strangest, most unusual place the two of you have ever made Whoopi? And the lady said, well, that would be in the A, Bob. I said, no, I need a location. So when they did the movie Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, they went to this lady and they said, Olga, we're going to put that clip in the movie. She says, no, please don't. I'm a grandmother now. And they said, well, it's worth $5,000. She said, you go right ahead and put it in. You know, a lot of people, I used to get calls from everyone that they said they saw it, but didn't see it. Never made the air.
Huh.
In the butt, Bob.
Yeah, your show had, because of, I guess, the content, many a blooper.
Oh, I guess. Well, yeah. Wasn't a whole lot, though. Is your wife there?
No.
No,
just me.
I was going to ask her a question.
Oh, I thought it was something you didn't want her to hear.
You're lucky. You know, one of my favorite questions. In the hamburger world of romance, is your husband a Big Mac, a quarter pounder, or where's the beef?
I could get her if you like, but it's so funny. And they do. I mean, I know they do these at various resorts and where, you know, where people are just getting married or newlyweds. They do. In fact, I think they did it when we went somewhere. We weren't even married yet, but they were performing the Newlywed.
Well, you know what I'm putting together, Jared? I'm putting together the $100,000 not so Newlywed game.
Really?
And I'll play the not so Newlywed game for married couples, and then the winning couple will have a chance to win $100,000, which I buy insurance for, and I want them to win. So I'm traveling that. And then I do a show called Backstage with the Beatles. I have a Beatle band on stage with me, and I tell never-before-heard stories that lead up to music. And then we also play casinos. We have a live game show called Hollywood's Greatest Game Shows. So when I can, about this stupid, you know, disease going on, I'm working pretty regularly and still having fun.
And where you tour all over the country or just regionally?
Yeah. Tour all over the country.
Oh.
It's really not work. My oldest son, who's a retired LA County fireman, he travels with me, does all of my audio visual. But the $100,000 not so Newlywed is a fun one. And we can play weddings, we can play, you know, corporate events, whatever it happens to be.
You said 83, but it doesn't seem like you're someone who is in going to retire, right?
No, I'm not going to retire. Heck no. I don't know if you've seen a commercial of our 60 up balance board.
Yes, I did. I was going to ask you a little about that.
Well, you know, I have a friend named Dan Metcalf, and Dan has 34 professional soccer players playing right now that he trained. And he saw me and I was walking kind of bent over. He said, "You're having mobility issues." I said, "Yep." He said, "Why don't you come over to my house?" So I went over to his house and we started working out. And during the next few months, he invented this balance board. And I can look anybody in the eye and tell them it changed my life. Yeah. I was falling down. It was just terrible. And so he invented it. And we tried it out on a few friends. And it worked so well that we raised about $1.5 million in 30 minutes. And the 60 up balance board hit the market, and we've helped thousands of people. It's amazing.
Wow. So you're like a co-owner of it?
Yeah.
So you really believe in it then? Okay.
It's really amazing.
I've seen some of the infomercials that you had for that.
If you have any kind of balance issues at all, it will help you, I promise.
That's great. I wanted to just, you mentioned about it coming back, the Newlywed game, and they've had it over the years. You brought it back. They had it in the 80s. You were doing it. Do you like that they keep bringing it back? Do you watch it?
No, because I don't like to see what they do to a format that I work so hard to perfect. I guess that's selfish, but that's why I contacted them and I said, look, I learned a lot doing Newlywed Game. And I said, I would be very happy to work as a consultant for you. Hmm. I said, not as a host, as a consultant. And they said, no, we don't need you. Okay.
Wow. That's not nice. I mean, you bring so much. Obviously, you did the show for however many years it was, 12 years or something like that. Between ABC and syndicated.
But back and forth.
Right, and longer, right.
Five decades. Yeah. The last show I did was for Game Show Network, and that was the one where Monty Hall I asked his wife, what's the strangest thing that ever happened to Monty besides making love in the bathroom? Come to find out, he got in the bathtub in New York at a hotel, and he got stuck, and they had to call 911 to get him out of the bathtub. But Monty was a good guy. If I have someone in my life that has helped me, Monty Hall certainly did. Hmm. Good guy. Barker and I, we don't get along.
who? Oh, Monty?
Bob Barker. Oh,
Bob Barker. You said Barker. Yeah.
Yeah. We were sharing a dressing room at CBS. I was doing card sharks and he was doing Price. And up on the wall was a beautiful, beautiful plaque, if you will. It said WGMC on it. So being a rascal I am, I took it off the wall and I put it under the couch. Now, I'm out at our ranch, and we're roving cattle. I get an emergency phone call from Jonathan Goodson. Where's Barker's plaque? I said, what plaque? He said, don't mess with me, man. He won't go on. He won't record shows until we find it. I said, oh, for God's sakes, it's under the couch. I said, what does WGMC mean? He says, world's greatest MC.
Wow. Did you, so you got along with him though, right?
Well, yes, whatever.
Okay. He's still going. He's 95 now, I believe.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't know it, but he is. Yeah.
Okay.
No, he's quite a character. Yeah. People walk up to me and say, hey, you're Bob Barker, aren't you? And I'll get real rude to them. And they'll go away and you say, Bob Barker's a jerk.
Oh, you said that. I see on Buzzer TV, you know, the channel that has all the game shows and Game Show Network, but they run a lot of marathons of Match Game, and once in a while you pop up on there, especially the later ones. I don't know about the earlier ones, but the later ones you're on. The Match Game Hollywood Squares one.
I've had a lot of fun. I really have. I'm very blessed, and I'm still having fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask, we talked about You Bet Your Life that you produced, I think it was 1980 with Buddy Hackett. There's a new one that just came on with Jay Leno. Did you get to catch that at all?
Oh, really? No, I didn't know anything. This is You Bet Your Life?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a syndicated one. So it's on before, well, I think it's on usually before primetime. And here it's at 7:30. Check your local listings, as they
on the 26th, I think, of this month. They're running a special of Price is Right.
Oh, are they? A primetime special?
For them. I said, you know, Bob Barker was the host. He did a great job. And then Drew Carey did something I didn't know anybody could do. He replaced Barker and did a good job. Yeah. So they're running that special on Price.
Yeah, they do some primetime ones on that. So you do like Drew doing it. I was wondering about that.
I like what?
You like Drew Carey doing
it. Yeah, he does a fine job. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go.
When I spoke to you the last time, it was all about Alex Trebek and what would happen with Jeopardy. And I do want to just circle back to that a moment, because there have been some changes and then not changes. And then, so I was wondering what your feeling is about what's going on there, which is still in flux.
Well, I was very confused that they spent all of that time bringing guest hosts on, and they ended up hiring the executive producer who was there all the time. You know, and I was confused about why they did that. Because I thought there were several people who did a good job. I really thought so. I couldn't do that. I told Alex one time, I can't even pronounce your name. I said, oh, God. He was a very nice man.
Alex. Yeah. Yeah. Your memories were great about him. And I thought so too. I mean, you had it, this cavalcade of people, actors, news people, who had come on there for, 6 months, I think, something like that. And, whether this was, you know, a stunt, I don't know. But it certainly, I think some people had a bad taste in their mouth when ultimately the executive producer, you know, gets both jobs, and then he doesn't keep the job anyway. We're watching it this one week.
Exactly.
But he did one day, which was five shows, and that's it. And actually, they say he's the host now instead of guest host, but now they switch it. What do you think of Mayim Bialik? She's going to be the... She's the other host. I don't know where that'll go.
I don't know. There were so many people who did a good job with it. I'm surprised that Johnny Gilbert is still there.
Right.
He's got to be 90 years old, man.
Yeah, I think so. It might even be, he might be even older than that. I think.
He worked for me a couple of times on shows years ago, but he's still in there banging away.
Yeah, and he's there. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. I think I've used up all your time. I don't.
I appreciate you calling me. Anytime I can help you, let me know. And I'll try to figure out what Zoom means.
Right. We'll get that. We'll get the video. We'll get you on here at some point. Thank you again for doing this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, my friend. God bless.
Thank you. The great Bob Eubanks. Comments or questions at HereNowTheNews1 on Twitter or email HereNowTheNewsJB@gmail.com. This is part of the Empty the Bench Podcast Network at ETB Network. Thanks for listening and subscribe to get updates on the latest episodes.